Chapter 17. That was Sunday night. Lena's child was born the next morning. It was just dawn when Byron stopped his galloping mule before the house, which he'd quitted not 6 hours ago. He sprang to the ground, already running, and ran up the narrow walk toward the dark porch. He seemed to stand aloof and watch himself, for all his haste, thinking with a kind of grim unsurprise. Byron Bunch, born and a baby. If I could have seen myself now 2 weeks ago, I wouldn't have believed my own eyes. I would have told them that they lied. The window was dark now, beyond which 6 hours ago he'd left the minister. Running, he thought of the bald head, the clenched hands, the prone, flabby body sprawled across the desk. But I reckon he hadn't slept much, he thought. Even if he ain't playing. He couldn't think of the word midwife, which he knew that Hightower would use. I reckon I don't have to think of it, he thought. Like a feller running from or toward a gun ain't got time to worry whether the word for what he's doing is courage or cowardice. The door wasn't locked. Apparently he knew that it wouldn't be. He felt his way into the hall, not quiet, not attempting to be. He'd never been deeper into the house than the room where he'd last seen the owner of it sprawled across the desk in the full down glare of the lamp. Yet he went almost as straight to the right door as if he knew or could see or were being led. That's what he'd call it, he thought, in the fumbling and hurried dark. And she would, too. He meant Lena, lying yonder in the cabin, already beginning to labor. Only they would both have a different name for whoever did the leading. He could hear Hightower snoring now, before he entered the room. Like he ain't so much upset after all, he thought. Then he thought immediately, no, that ain't right. That ain't just, because I don't believe that. I know the reason he is asleep, and I ain't asleep, is that he's an old man and can't stand as much as I can stand. He approached the bed. The still invisible occupant snored profoundly. There was a quality of profound and complete surrender in it. Not of exhaustion, but surrender. As though he'd given over and relinquished completely that grip upon that blending of pride and hope and vanity and fear, that strength to cling to either defeat or victory, which is the I am, and the relinquishment of which is usually death. Standing beside the bed, Byron thought again, a poor thing. It seemed to him now that to wake the man from that sleep would be the sorest injury which he'd ever done him. But it ain't me that's waiting, he thought. God knows that. "'Cause I reckon he's been watching me, too, lately, like the rest of them, to see what I'll do next.' He touched the sleeper, not roughly, but firmly. Hightower ceased in mid-snore beneath Byron's hand. He surged hugely and suddenly up. "'Yes?' he said. "'What? Who is it? Who's there?' "'It's me,' Byron said. "'It's Byron again. You awake now?' "'Yes, what?' "'Yes,' Byron said. "'She says it's about due now, that the time has come.' "'She? Tell me where the light... "'Miss Hines, she's out there. I'm going on for the doctor.' But it may take some time, so you can take my mule. I reckon you'd ride that far. Have you still got your book? The bed creaked as Hightower moved. Book? My book? The book you used when that nigger baby came. I just wanted to remind you in case you'd need to take it with you, in case I don't get back with the doctor in time. The mule's out at the gate. He knows the way. I'll walk on to town and get the doctor. I'll get back out there as soon as I can." He turned and recrossed the room. He could hear, feel, the other sitting up in the bed. He paused in the middle of the floor long enough to find the suspended light and turn it on. When it came on, he was already moving on toward the door. He didn't look back. Behind him, he heard Hightower's voice. "Byron! Byron!" He didn't pause, didn't answer. Dawn was increasing. He walked rapidly along the empty street, beneath the spaced and failing street lamps, about which bugs still whirled and blundered. But day was growing. When he reached the square, the facade of its eastern side was in sharp relief against the sky. He was thinking rapidly. He'd made no arrangement with the doctor. Now, as he walked, he was cursing himself in all the mixed terror and rage of any actual young father for what he now believed to have been crass and criminal negligence. Yet it wasn't exactly the solicitude of an incipient father. There was something else behind it, which he wasn't to recognize until later. It was as though there lurked in his mind, still obscured by the need for haste, something which was about to spring full-clawed upon him. But what he was thinking was, "I gotta decide quick. He delivered that nigger baby all right, they said, but this is different. I ought to have done it last week, seen ahead about a doctor instead of waiting. Having to explain now, at the last minute, hunt from house to house, till I find one that'll come, that'll believe the lies that I'll have to tell. I'd be dog if it don't look like a man that's done as much lying lately as I have could tell a lie now that anybody'd believe, man or woman. But it don't look like I can. I reckon it just ain't in me to tell a good lie and do it well." He walked rapidly, his footsteps hollow and lonely in the empty street. Already his decision was made without his even being aware of it. To him there was nothing either of paradox or of comedy about it. It had entered his mind too quickly and was too firmly established there when he became aware of it. His feet were already obeying it. They were taking him to the home of the same doctor who'd arrived too late at the delivery of the Negro child at which Hightower had officiated with his razor and his book. The doctor arrived too late this time also. Byron had to wait for him to dress. He was an oldish man now, and fussy, and somewhat disgruntled at having been wakened at this hour. Then he had to hunt for the switch key to his car, which he kept in a small metal strong box, the key to which, in turn, he couldn't find at once. And neither would he allow Byron to break the lock. So when they reached the cabin at last, the east was primrose color, and there was already a hint of the swift sun of summer. And again the two men, both older now, met at the door of a one-room cabin, the professional having lost again to the amateur. For as he entered the door, the doctor heard the infant cry. The doctor blinked at the minister fretfully. "Well, doctor," he said, "I wish Byron had told me he'd already called you in. I'd still be in bed." He thrust past the minister, entering. "You seem to have had better luck this time than you did the last time we consulted. Only you look about like you need a doctor yourself. Or maybe it's a cup of coffee you need." Hightower said something, but the doctor had gone on without stopping to listen. He entered the room where a young woman, whom he'd never seen before, lay wan and spent on a narrow army cot, and an old woman in a purple dress, whom he'd also never seen before, held the child upon her lap. There was an old man asleep on a second cot in the shadow. When the doctor noticed him, he said to himself that the man looked like he was dead, so profoundly and peacefully did he sleep. But the doctor didn't notice the old man at once. He went to the old woman who held the child. "Well, well," he said. "Byron must have been excited. He never told me the whole family would be on hand, Grandpa and Grandma, too." The woman looked up at him. He thought, she looks about as much alive as he does for all she's sitting up. Don't look like she's got enough gumption to know she's even a parent, let alone a grandparent. Yes, the woman said. She looked up at him, crouching over the child. Then he saw that her face wasn't stupid, vacuous. He saw that at the same time it was both peaceful and terrible, as though the peace and the terror had both died long ago and come to live again at the same time. But he remarked mainly her attitude, at once like a rock and like a crouching beast. She jerked her head at the man. For the first time, the doctor looked full at him where he lay sleeping upon the other cot. She said, in a whisper at once cunning and tense with fading terror, "I fooled him. I told him you would come in the back way this time. I fooled him. But now you're here. You can see to Millie now. I'll take care of Joey." Then this faded. While he watched, the life, the vividness faded, fled suddenly from a face that looked too still, too dull to ever have harbored it. Now the eyes questioned him with a gaze dumb, inarticulate, baffled, as she crouched over the child, as if he'd offered to drag it from her. Her movement roused it, perhaps. It cried once. Then the bafflement, too, flowed away. It fled as smoothly as a shadow. She looked down at the child, musing, wooden-faced, ludicrous. "It's Joey," she said. "It's my Millie's little boy." And Byron, outside the door where he'd stopped as the doctor entered, heard that cry and something terrible happened to him. Mrs. Hines had called him from his tent. There was something in her voice so that he put on his trousers as he ran, almost, and he passed Mrs. Hines, who hadn't undressed at all, in the cabin door and ran into the room. Then he saw her, and it stopped him dead as a wall. Mrs. Hines was at his elbow, talking to him. Perhaps he answered, talked back. Anyway, he'd saddled the mule and was already galloping toward town while he still seemed to be looking at her, at her face as she lay raised on her propped arms on the cot, looking down at the shape of her body beneath the sheet with wailing and hopeless terror. He saw that all the time he was waking Hightower, all the time he was getting the doctor started, while somewhere in him the clawed thing lurked and waited and thought was going too fast to give him time to think. That was it. Thought too swift for thinking. Until he and the doctor returned to the cabin. And then, just outside the cabin door where he'd stopped, he heard the child cry once, and something terrible happened to him. He knew now what it was that seemed to lurk clawed and waiting while he crossed the empty square, seeking the doctor, whom he'd neglected to engage. He knew now why he neglected to engage a doctor beforehand. It is because he didn't believe until Mrs. Hines called him from his tent that she, would need one, would have the need. It was like for a week now his eyes had accepted her belly without his mind believing. "Yet I did know, believe," he thought. "I must have knowed to have done what I've done, the running and the lying and the worrying at folks." But he saw now that he didn't believe until he passed Mrs. Hines and looked into the cabin. When Mrs. Hines' voice first came into his sleeping, he knew what it was, what had happened. He rose and put on, like a pair of hurried overalls, the need for haste. Knowing why, knowing that for 5 nights now he'd been expecting it. Yet he still didn't believe. He knew now that when he ran to the cabin and looked in, he expected to see her sitting up, perhaps to be met by her at the door, placid, unchanged, timeless. But even as he touched the door with his hand, he heard something which he'd never heard before. It was a moaning wail, loud, with a quality at once passionate and abject, that seemed to be speaking clearly to something in a tongue which he knew wasn't his tongue nor that of any man. Then he passed Mrs. Hines in the door, and he saw her lying on the cot. He'd never seen her in bed before, and he believed that when, or if he ever did, she would be tense, alert, maybe smiling a little, and completely aware of him. But when he entered, she didn't even look at him. She didn't even seem to be aware that the door had opened, that there was anyone or anything in the room save herself, and whatever it was that she had spoken to with that wailing cry in a tongue unknown to man. She was covered to the chin, yet her upper body was raised upon her arms, and her head was bent. Her hair was loose, and her eyes looked like two holes, and her mouth was as bloodless now as the pillow behind her. And as she seemed, in that attitude of alarm and surprise, to contemplate with a kind of outraged unbelief the shape of her body beneath the covers, she gave again that loud, abject, wailing cry. Mrs. Hines was now bending over. She turned her head, that wooden face across her purple shoulder. "Git," she said. "Git for the doctor. Come now." He didn't remember going to the stable at all, yet there he was, catching his mule, dragging the saddle out, and clapping it on. He was working fast, yet thinking went slow enough. He knew why now. He knew now that thinking went slow and smooth with calculation, as oil is spread slowly upon a surface above a brewing storm. "If I'd known then," he thought, "if I'd known then, if it had got through then." He thought this quietly, in a ghast despair, regret. "Yeah, I would have turned my back and rode the other way. Beyond the knowing and memory of man forever and ever, I reckon I would have rode." But he didn't. He passed the cabin at a gallop, with thinking going smooth and steady, he not yet knowing why. "If I can just get past and out of hearing before she hollers again," he thought. "If I can just get past before I have to hear her again." That carried him for a while into the road, the hard-muscled small beast going fast now, thinking, the oil spreading steady and smooth. "I'll go to Hightower first. I'll leave the mule for him. I must remember to remind him about his doctor book. I mustn't forget that," the oil said, getting him that far, to where he sprang from the still-running mule and into Hightower's house. Then he had something else. "Now that's done," thinking, "even if I can't get a regular doctor." That got him to the square, and then betrayed him. He could feel it, clawed with lurking, thinking, "even if I don't get a regular doctor, because I never believed that I would need one, I didn't believe." It was in his mind, galloping and yoked in a headlong paradox with the need for haste, while he helped the old doctor hunt for the key to the strong box in order to get the switch key for the car. They found it at last, and for a time the need for haste went hand in hand with movement, speed, along the empty road beneath the empty dawn. That, or he'd surrendered all reality, all dread and fear, to the doctor beside him, as people do. Anyway, it got him back to the cabin, where the two of them left the car and approached the cabin door, beyond which the lamp still burned. For that interval he ran into the final hiatus of peace before the blow fell and the clawed thing overtook him from behind. Then he heard the child cry. Then he knew. Dawn was making fast. He stood quietly in the chill peace, the waking quiet, small, nondescript, whom no man or woman had ever turned to look at twice anywhere. He knew now that there had been something all the while which had protected him against believing. With the believing protected him. With stern and austere astonishment, he thought, "It was like it wasn't until Miss Hines called me and I heard her and saw her face and knew that Byron Bunch was nothing in this world to her right then, that I found out that she's not a virgin. And he thought that that was terrible, but that wasn't all. There was something else. His head wasn't bowed. He stood quite still in the augmenting dawn, while thinking went quietly. "And this, too, is reserved for me, as Reverend Hightower says. I'll have to tell him now. I'll have to tell Lucas Birch." It wasn't unsurprised now. It was something like the terrible and irremediable despair of adolescence. Well, I didn't even believe until now that he was so. It was like me and her and all the other folks that I had to get mixed up in it were just a lot of words that never even stood for anything, weren't even us. While all the time, what was us was going on and going on without even missing the lack of words. Yeah. It ain't until now that I ever believed that he's Lucas Birch. That there ever was a Lucas Birch.
"Luck," Hightower says. "Luck. I don't know whether I had it or not. But the doctor has gone on into the cabin. Looking back for another moment, Hightower watches the group about the cot, hearing still the doctor's cheery voice. The old woman now sits quietly, yet looking back at her, it seems but a moment ago that he was struggling with her for the child, lest she drop it in her dumb and furious terror. But no less furious for being dumb it was, as the child, snatched almost from the mother's body, she held it high aloft, her heavy, bear-like body crouching as she glared at the old man asleep on the cot. He was sleeping so when Hightower arrived. He didn't seem to breathe at all, and beside the cot the woman was crouching in a chair when he entered. She looked exactly like a rock poised to plunge over a precipice, and for an instant Hightower thought, she's already killed him. She has taken her precautions well beforehand this time. Then he was quite busy. The old woman was at his elbow without his being aware of it until she snatched the still unbreathing child and held it aloft, glaring at the old sleeping man on the other cot with the face of a tiger. Then the child breathed and cried, and the woman seemed to answer it, also in no known tongue, savage and triumphant. Her face was almost maniacal as he struggled with her and took the child from her before she dropped it. "See," he said. "Look, he's quiet. He's not going to take it away this time." Still she glared at him, dumb, beast-like, as though she didn't understand English. But the fury, the triumph, had gone from her face. She made a hoarse, whimpering noise, trying to take the child from him. "Careful now," he said. "Will you be careful?" She nodded, whimpering, pawing lightly at the child. But her hands were steady, and he let her have it. And she now sits with it upon her lap, while the doctor, who had arrived too late, stands beside the cot, talking in his cheerful, testy voice, while his hands are busy. Hightower turns and goes out, lowering himself carefully down the broken step to the earth, like an old man, as if there were something in his flabby paunch fatal and highly keyed like dynamite. It's now more than dawn, it's morning, already the sun. He looks about, pausing. He calls, "Byron?" There's no answer. Then he sees that the mule, which he had tethered to a fence post nearby, is also gone. He sighs. Well, he thinks, so I have reached the point where the crowning indignity which I am to suffer at Byron's hands is a 2-mile walk back home. And that's not worthy of Byron, of hatred. But so often our deeds aren't, nor we of our deeds. He walks back to town slowly, a gaunt, paunched man in a soiled Panama hat and the tail of a coarse cotton nightshirt thrust into his black trousers. "Luckily, I did take time to put on my shoes," he thinks. "I am tired," he thinks, fretfully. "I am tired, and I shall not be able to sleep." He's thinking it fretfully, wearily, keeping time to his feet when he turns into his gate. The sun is now high. The town is wakened. He smells the smoke here and there of cooking breakfasts. "The least thing he could have done," he thinks, "since he would not leave me the mule, would have been to ride ahead and start a fire in my stove for me. Since he thinks it better for my appetite to take a 2-mile stroll before eating." He goes to the kitchen and builds a fire in the stove, slowly, clumsily. As clumsily after 25 years as on the first day he'd ever attempted it, and puts coffee on. "Then I'll go back to bed," he thinks. "But I know I shall not sleep." But he notices that his thinking sounds querulous, like the peaceful whining of a querulous woman who isn't even listening to herself. Then he finds that he is preparing his usual hearty breakfast, and he stops quite still, clicking his tongue as though in displeasure. "I ought to feel worse than I do," he thinks. But he has to admit that he doesn't. And as he stands, tall, misshapen, lonely in his lonely and ill-kept kitchen, holding in his hand an iron skillet in which yesterday's old grease is bleakly caked, there goes through him a glow, a wave, a surge of something almost hot, almost triumphant. "I showed them," he thinks. "Life comes to the old man yet. Well, they get there too late. They get there for his leavings, as Byron would say. But this is vanity and empty pride." Yet the slow and fading glow disregards it, impervious to reprimand. He thinks, "What if I do? What if I do feel it? Triumph and pride, what if I do?" But the warmth, the glow, evidently doesn't regard or need buttressing either. Neither is it quenched by the actuality of an orange and eggs and toast. And he looks down at the soiled and empty dishes on the table, and he says aloud now, "Bless my soul, I'm not even going to wash them now." Neither does he go to his bedroom to try to sleep. He goes to the door and looks in with that glow of purpose and pride, thinking, "If I were a woman now, that's what a woman would do. Go back to bed to rest." He goes to the study. He moves like a man with a purpose now who for 25 years has been doing nothing at all between the time to wake and the time to sleep again. Neither is the book which he now chooses the Tennyson. This time also he chooses food for a man. It's Henry IV. And he goes out into the backyard and lies down in the sagging deck chair beneath the mulberry tree, plumping solidly and heavily into it. "But I shan't be able to sleep," he thinks, "because Byron will be in soon to wake me. But to learn just what else he can think of to want me to do will be almost worth the waking." He goes to sleep soon, almost immediately, snoring. Anyone pausing to look down into the chair would have seen, beneath the twin glares of sky and the spectacles, a face innocent, peaceful, and assured. But no one comes, though when he wakes almost 6 hours later, he seems to believe that someone has called him. He sits up abruptly, the chair creaking beneath him. "Yes," he says, "yes, what is it?" But there's no one there, though for a moment longer he looks about, seeming to listen and to wait, with that air forceful and assured. And the glow isn't gone either. though I had hoped to sleep it off, he thinks, thinking at once, no, I don't mean hoped. What is in my thought is feared. And so I have surrendered too. He thinks, quiet, still. He begins to rub his hands gently at first, a little guiltily. I have surrendered too, and I will permit myself. Yes. Perhaps this too is reserved for me, and so I shall permit myself. And then he says it, thinks it. That child that I delivered, I have no namesake, but I have known them before this to be named by a grateful mother for the doctor who officiated. But then there is Byron. Byron, of course, will take the part of me. She will have to have others. Moa, remembering the young, strong body, from out whose travail even there shone something tranquil and unafraid. Moa of them. Many more. That will be her life, her destiny. The good stock, peopling in tranquil obedience to it, the good earth. From these haughty loins, without hurry or haste, descending mother and daughter. But by Byron engendered next. Poor boy, even though he did let me walk back home. He enters the house. He shaves and removes the nightshirt and puts on the shirt which he'd worn yesterday, and a collar, and the lawn tie and the Panama hat. The walk out to the cabin doesn't take him as long as the walk home did, even though he goes now through the woods where the walking is harder. I must do this more often, he thinks, feeling the intermittent sun, the heat, smelling the savage and fecund odor of the earth, the woods, the loud silence. I should never have lost this habit, too, but perhaps they will both come back to me, if this itself be not the same as prayer. He emerges from the woods at the far side of the pasture behind the cabin. Beyond the cabin he can see the clump of trees in which the house had stood and burned, though from here he can't see the charred and mute embers of what were once planks and beams. Poor woman, he thinks, poor barren woman, to have not lived only a week longer, until luck returned to this place, until luck and life returned to these barren and ruined acres. It seems to him that he can see, feel about him, the ghosts of rich fields and of the rich, fecund, black life of the quarters, the mellow shouts, the presence of fecund women, the prolific naked children in the dust before the doors, and the big house again, noisy, loud, with the treble shouts of the generations. He reaches the cabin. He doesn't knock. With his hand already opening the door, he calls in a hearty voice that almost booms, "Can the doctor come in?" The cabin is empty, save for the mother and child. She is propped up on the cot, the child at breast. As Hightower enters, she's in the act of drawing the sheet up over her bared bosom, watching the door not with alarm at all, but with alertness, her face fixed in an expression serene and warm, as though she were about to smile. He sees this fade. "I thought," she says. "Who did you think?" he says, booms. He comes to the cot and looks down at her, at the tiny, weazened terracotta face of the child, which seems to hang suspended, without body, and still asleep, from the breast. Again she draws the sheet closer, modest and tranquil, while above her the gaunt, paunched, bald man stands with an expression on his face, gentle, beaming, and triumphant. She's looking down at the child. "It looks like he just can't get caught up. I think he's asleep again, and I lay him down, and then he hollers, and I have to put him back again." "You ought not to be here alone," he says, He looks about the room. Well, she's gone too. To town. She didn't say, but that's where she's gone. He slipped out, and when she woke up, she asked me where he was, and I told her he went out, and she followed him. To town. Slipped out. Then he says, oh, quietly. His face is grave now. She watched him all day, and he was watching her, I could tell it. He was making out like he was asleep. She thought that he was asleep. So after dinner, she gave out. She hadn't rested any last night, and after dinner, she sat in the chair and dozed. And he was watching her. And he gets up from the other cot, careful, winking and squinching his face at me. He went to the door, still winking and squinting back at me over his shoulder, and tiptoed out. And I never tried to stop him, to wake her neither. She looks at Hightower, her eyes grave, wide. I was scared, too. He talks funny. And the way he's looking at me. Like all the winking and squinching wasn't for me not to wake her up, but to tell me what would happen to me if I did. And I was scared to. So I laid here with the baby, and pretty soon she jerked awake. And then I knew she hadn't aimed to go to sleep. It was like she come awake already, running to the cot where he'd been, touching it like she couldn't believe he'd done got away. Because she stood there at the cot, pawing at the blanket like maybe she thought he was mislaid inside the blanket somewhere. Then she looked at me once, and she wasn't winking and squinting, but I wish she was. And she asked me, and I told her, and she put on a hat and went out. She looks at Hightower. I'm glad she's gone. I reckon I ought not to say it after all she done for me, but... Hightower stands over the cot. He doesn't seem to see her. His face is very grave. It's almost like it had grown 10 years older while he stood there. Or like his face looks now as it should look, and that when he entered the room it had been a stranger to itself. To town, he says. Then his eyes wake, seeing again. Well, it can't be helped now, he says. Besides, the men downtown... the sane. There will be a few of them. Why are you glad they're gone? She looks down. Her hand moves about the baby's head, not touching it. A gesture instinctive, unneeded, apparently unconscious of itself. She has been kind, more than kind, holding the baby so I could rest. She wants to hold him all the time, sitting there in that chair. Well, you'll have to excuse me. I ain't once invited you to sit. She watches him as he draws the chair up to the cot and sits down. Sitting there where she could watch him on the cot, making out that he's asleep. She looks at Hightower. Her eyes are questioning, intent. She keeps on calling him Joey. When his name ain't Joey. And she keeps on... She watches Hightower. Her eyes are puzzled now, questioning, doubtful. She keeps on talking about... She's mixed up some way. And sometimes I get mixed up too, listening. Happen to... Her eyes, her words, grope, fumble. Mixed up. She keeps on talking about him like his pa was that... the one in jail, that Mr. Christmas. She keeps on, and then I get mixed up, and it's like sometimes I can't... Like I'm mixed up, too, and I think that his pa is that Mr. Christmas, too. She watches him. It's as though she makes a tremendous effort of some kind. But I know that ain't so. I know that's foolish. It's because she keeps on saying it and saying it, and maybe I ain't strong good yet, and I get mixed up too. But I'm afraid of what? I don't like to get mixed up. And I'm afraid she might get me mixed up. Like they say how you might cross your eyes and then you can't uncross. She stops looking at him. She doesn't move. She can feel him watching her. You say the baby's name is not Joe. What is his name? For a moment longer, she doesn't look at Hightower. Then she looks up. She says, too immediately, too easily, I ain't named him yet. And he knows why. It's as though he sees her for the first time since he entered. He notices for the first time that her hair has been recently combed, and that she's freshened her face, too. And he sees, half hidden by the sheet, as if she'd thrust them hurriedly there when he entered, a comb and a shard of broken mirror. When I came in, you were expecting someone. And it wasn't me. Who were you expecting? She doesn't look away. Her face is neither innocent nor dissimulating. Neither is it placid and serene. Expecting? Was it Byron Bunch you expected? Still, she doesn't look away. Hightower's face is sober, firm, gentle. Yet in it is that ruthlessness which she's seen in the faces of a few good people, men, usually, whom she's known. He leans forward and lays his hand on hers where it supports the child's body. Byron is a good man, he says. I reckon I know that. Well, as anybody. Better than most. And you are a good woman. Will be. I don't mean, he says quickly. Then he ceases. I didn't mean. I reckon I know, she says. No, not this. This doesn't matter. This is not anything yet. It all depends on what you do with it afterward. With yourself. With others. He looks at her. She doesn't look away. Let him go. Send him away from you. They look at one another. Send him away, daughter. You are probably not much more than half his age, but you've already outlived him twice over. He will never overtake you, catch up with you, because he has wasted too much time. And that, too, his nothing, is as irremediable as your all. He can no more ever cast back and do than you can cast back and undo. You have a man-child that is not his, by a man that is not him. You will be forcing into his life two men and only the third part of a woman, who deserves at the least that the nothing with which he has lived for 35 years be violated, if violated it must be, without two witnesses. Send him away. That ain't for me to do. He's free. Ask him. I haven't tried once to hold him. That's it. You probably could not have held him if you'd tried to. That's it. If you had known how to try. But then if you'd known that, you wouldn't be here in this cot with this child at your breast. And you won't send him away? You won't say the word? I can say no more than I have said.
and I said no to him 5 days ago. No. He said for me to marry him, to not wait. And I said no. Would you say no now?
She looks at him steadily.
Yes, I would say it now.
He sighs, huge, shapeless. His face is again slack, weary.
I believe you. You will continue to say it until after you have seen.
He looks at her again. Again, his gaze is intent, hard.
Where is he?
Byron. She looks at him. After a while, she says quietly,
I don't know.
She looks at him. Suddenly her face is quite empty, as though something which gave it actual solidity and firmness were beginning to drain out of it. Now there's nothing of dissimulation, nor alertness, nor caution in it. This morning, about 10 o'clock, he came back. He didn't come in. He just came to the door, and he stood there, and he just looked at me. And I hadn't seen him since last night, and he hadn't seen the baby. And I said, come and see him. And he looked at me, standing there in the door. And he said, I come to find out when you want to see him. And I said, see who? And he said, they may have to send a deputy with him, but I can persuade Kennedy to let him come. And I said, let who come? And he said, Lucas, Birch. And I said, yes. And he said, this evening? Will that do? And I said, yes. And he went away. He just stood there, and then he went away. While he watches her with that despair of all men in the presence of female tears, she begins to cry. She sits upright, the child at her breast, crying, not loud and not hard, but with a patient and hopeless abjectness, not hiding her face.
And you worry me about if I said no or not. And I already said no. And you worry me and worry me. And now he's already gone. I'll never see him again.
And he sits there, and she bows her head at last. And he rises and stands over her with his hand on her bowed head, thinking,
thank God. God help me. Thank God. God help me.
This ends Disc 13.
He found Christmas's old path through the woods to the mill. He didn't know that it was there, but when he found in which direction it ran, it seemed like an omen to him in his exultation. He believes her, but he wants to corroborate the information for the sheer pleasure of hearing it again. It's just 4 o'clock when he reaches the mill. He inquires at the office.
Bunch, the bookkeeper says, you won't find him here. He quit this morning.
I know, Hightower says. Been with the company for 7 years. Saturday evenings, too. Then this morning he walked in, said he was quitting. No reason. But that's the way these hillbillies do.
Yes, Hightower says. They are fine people, though. Fine men and women.
He leaves the office. The road to town passes the planer shed where Byron worked. He knows Mooney, the foreman.
"I hear Byron Bunch is not with you anymore," he says, pausing.
"Yeah," Mooney says, "he quit this morning."
But Hightower isn't listening. The overalled men watch the shabby, queer-shaped, not-quite-familiar figure, looking with a kind of exultant interest at the walls, the planks, the cryptic machinery whose very being and purpose he couldn't have understood or even learned.
"If you want to see him," Mooney says, "I reckon you'll find him downtown at the courthouse."
"At the courthouse?"
"Yes, sir. Grand jury meets today, special call, to indict that murderer."
"Yes, yes," Hightower says. "So he is gone, yes. A fine young man. Good day, gentlemen, good day to you."
He goes on while the men in overalls look after him for a time. His hands are clasped behind him. He paces on, thinking quietly, peacefully, sadly. Poor man. Poor fellow. No man is, can be, justified in taking human life. Least of all, a warranted officer, a sworn servant of his fellow man. When it is sanctioned publicly in the person of an elected officer who knows that he hasn't himself suffered at the hands of his victim, call that victim by what name you will, how can we expect an individual to refrain when he believes that he has suffered at the hands of his victim?
He walks on. He's now in his own street. Soon he can see his fence, the signboard, then the house beyond the rich foliage of August. So he departed, without coming to tell me goodbye. After all he's done for me, fetched to me, aye, given, restored to me. It would seem that this, too, was reserved for me. And this must be all. But it's not all. There's one thing more reserved for him.